Welcome to part three of our immune system assessment module. This is about food intolerance, autoimmunity, and inflammation testing. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I can't wait to share this information with you that is super valuable for you as you start to work with people with immune challenges, which is going to be a lot of the people that you see, and to really support them and to know what tests you can run. So before we begin, I just want to make sure that you're aware that everything that I'm presenting here is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's not medical advice. And as you work with your clients, I want you to make sure that they're aware that what you're doing is providing them with education about what's going on in their body. When you do tests with them, you're providing education about what's going on in their body. And it's not about diagnosis, and it's not about creating a treatment plan. It's all about helping to empower people to take charge of their own health. So if they are under the care of a doctor or they are on medication of any kind, make sure that you let them know that it's important that they communicate with their doctor and make sure that what you're teaching them is in alignment with what their doctor is supporting them on. As I said, this module, this part of the module, part three, is actually composed of three different sections that I want to go through with you. The first part is what kind of lab testing can you do for food reactions? The second part is about autoimmune testing. I've inserted a little bit of something in there on oxidative stress, but I consider that part of the inflammatory pathways. Then we look at inflammatory pathways and how you can test for those. So let's start out by looking at the lab tests for food reactions. I'm going to start this conversation by saying I generally don't like these. I generally find them to be relatively inaccurate. I find them to be confusing, and it can oftentimes be overwhelming for people. So from the start, I'll say that my preference is to, as much as possible, get information about what the person's sensitive to based on a history, based on asking questions, based on doing an elimination diet or a rare foods diet or even some short fasting to get a sense of it. But that all that said, there are times when we need to turn to labs where we're not getting the information that we need or want from doing the elimination diets, from doing the provocations, and from really just listening in. And because the person's impatient, and a lot of people have heard about or read about food allergy testing, and they want to get their food allergy testing. So let's go through what's available, and then we can talk more about like going through some examples. To start out, we have the inhalant allergy tests. They're the conventional medical testing for allergies, which is the skin prick test. So we take the allergen, the antigen, and little spot is poked in the skin, and those are introduced, and we look for whether there's a wheal, you know, a area of redness that forms around that. The problem with that is that it generally only tests for immediate hypersensitivities, what's called an IgE reaction, and we'll go through some of those antibodies and what they mean. And when you only test for an IgE reaction, you're not giving a person as much information as makes sense. So what I mean by that is most people know what their immediate hypersensitivities are. So for food testing, it doesn't make any sense. For inhalants, it does, because you don't know if you're sensitive to dog or cat or a particular strain of it or grass, particular plants. So for inhalant allergies, it makes sense to try to identify those substances so the person can make an attempt at avoiding. Can't always avoid grass and all that kind of stuff, but it's good to know. But in terms of food, the kinds of things that would be picked up by a skin prick test are the things you probably already know. You eat strawberries, you get hives. You eat soybeans and your throat closes up. You go into anaphylaxis. Those are the ones you already know about. So it doesn't really make sense to do skin prick tests for those inhalant allergies. The others that you can do are blood tests, stool tests, and saliva tests. So let's talk about each of those. And I'm going to call it food intolerance because not all of these are testing for an allergic reaction. Allergic reaction is actually very specific. It's specifically a reaction that's looking for antibodies. So most of these tests we're going to talk about do look for antibodies. Those would be food allergy. But this other test, the ALCAT test, actually isn't really looking for allergies as much as an immune response, a sensitivity, if you will. So the ALCAT test we'll talk about in more detail, and I have an example from a client that I did. The other area is blood antibody tests. We can test for antibodies in the blood, and I'll show you a slide where I'll show you the different types of antibodies that can be tested in the blood. Then there's stool antibody tests, and then there's saliva. So with the blood antibody tests, there's different kinds of antibodies that you can test for. IgA, IgE, IgG, IgM. And we went through that in the main immune system mastery module. So you should know what those are. And we'll review those when we get to that slide. I find that those are really good for picking up those delayed sensitivity reactions where you eat a food and maybe 3 days later, 3 hours later, 4 hours later, there's a reaction. And because you've eaten other foods along with it, you've had maybe a second or third meal in the meantime, you have no clue. So those pick up things, but they're not necessarily all that accurate. And that's my biggest beef with them. I find that the stool antibody test can be a little bit more accurate. Just because, here's the thing, if a person has been avoiding a food because they suspect they're allergic to it, and then they go and get a blood test to see if they're allergic to it, the level of the antibodies will have gone down substantially in most cases. And so you're really not going to capture it unless they go back and start eating it again. And I'm not a big fan of asking people to go back and eat a bunch of foods that they haven't eaten for a while because they were having a reaction to it. And finally, there's a saliva antibody test that's not really done all that much. There used to be on the diagnostics adrenal stress test that they would test for gluten antibodies. I don't think they do that anymore. But the problem is people, when they're under stress, are very low in IgAs, which is what they're testing, right? And when you're low in an IgA, secretory IgA is what it's called. It's the immunoglobulins that are produced by the secretory cells, the mucous membranes. But that level goes down when a person's under chronic stress. So if you're measuring for antibodies in the saliva, you may get a false negative reading if the person is under a lot of stress. Now, that said, you can also get a false negative on a blood antibody test if the person is suppressed, immune suppressed. So they have low overall immunoglobulin levels. And that happens in people who have stressed out immune systems. And sometimes when you test somebody who you suspect has a whole bunch of allergies, or they suspect it and it doesn't show up, it shows up as like normal or almost nothing or nothing, then you might suspect an immunoglobulin deficiency. So those are the things to keep in mind when you're actually doing these tests. And I've seen that happen a bunch on the Cyrex labs. They have, I think it's a Array 10 that they have that tests for a whole slew of antibodies. And they actually say you should go back and eat the foods for at least 3 to 4 weeks if you've been away from them in order for it to show positive. So that's not always as practical. That said, I've done all these tests and there are situations. And you have to just evaluate the situation rather than jump right in and get the testing done. There's a gluten stool test, which is done by Intero Lab, and I like that. They also do much more than that, but I wanted to point out that, and we'll go into a little bit more detail in a few slides. And then finally, I'm putting down here the gluten cross-reactivity test from Cyrex Labs, and the thing about the gluten cross-reactivity is that there's certain things that can mimic gluten in the body or cross-react to it. And they're oftentimes those same foods that people replace their gluten with. So they start to eat all these different flour products that are made from different grains, and that can be developed. So when somebody's not doing really well on a gluten-free diet and you really suspect that gluten is part of it, especially if there's autoimmunity involved, then I would suspect that if you take them off the gluten and there's other things that they're cross-reacting to, that's what's happening. So there's a cross-reactivity panel, and the cross-reactivity panel will go through and show you the various, like there's about 15 or 20 different foods. So let's jump in and get into a little bit more detail. We'll start with the ALCAT food intolerance test. The ALCAT test is a blood test, and what it does, instead of measuring the amount of an antibody in the system, what it's doing is a stimulation test. So they call it an antigen leukocyte antibody test. So basically, they identify cellular reactions, not antibody reaction, but a cellular reaction. So they're injecting the white blood cells, the leukocytes, with these food particles and looking for the reaction, looking for an inflammatory reaction, and then they put it down. And they rate it as normal, mild, moderate, or severe. So there's four levels that they rate it on. So they basically add the food allergen to what's called a leukocyte suspension. So basically a suspension of white blood cells. So they separate out the blood when they get it. They take the white blood cells, they inject them with this stuff, and they look to see what the reaction is. My concern with this is it's fairly subjective, right? Because you've got people looking at it to measure through a microscope what's going on in here. So it's really not an objective measurement. There's a lot of skepticism about this test. If you go online and start searching on it, you'll find just as much negative press about it as positive press, maybe even more on the negative side. And of course, you know, there's always the quackbusters that are going to put down everything. I've seen, you can get good reactions with this, but the way that you test with this is a little different than the way that you would test for like an IgA or IgE reaction. So if you do a blood test and you get this reaction and there's somebody has severe reaction to five different foods, you're going to take them off those foods for a while. Then you're going to wait and remeasure, maybe 6 months if they're severe, and you go back and measure again to see if they're no longer sensitive to it. With the ALCAT, it might be actually a little bit different. What they say is that you test the person, and then you take them off these foods, right? And then what you do is reintroduce the foods before testing again. So it's a little bit different, and it's a little bit kind of guesswork because you don't know if you're ready to reintroduce those foods. And then you test, and you go, whoops, they're still sensitive to it. So I have mixed feelings about it, and I'll show you an example of it. So this is what the report looks like, and this is an actual report from one of my clients. Pretty impressive, eh? So the green is what she can eat. The yellow is what she has a mild reaction to. The orange, she has a moderate, and the red, severe. So she's got a lot of stuff that she's severe. So what do we think this is? Well, there's a leaky gut going on. If you're reacting to that many foods, it means that many foods have entered into the bloodstream at some point and stimulated. Okay, if you take this to heart. So this was hard to put her on a program. You know, we had to create a whole menu plan, a complete kind of recipe book, because I'd take some of my basic recipes and have to tweak around the ingredients so that she could eat it. So she wasn't just sitting down and eating these plain foods because she liked to eat good food. So it becomes a little bit strenuous, to say the least, for the person to follow it, but also for you as a practitioner to try to put a plan together. And I'll show you when I show you the actual test, some of the what they give you, but it's okay what they give you. It gives you kind of a rotation diet. I've never really used their rotation diet because oftentimes they build into those rotation diets foods that maybe the person isn't sensitive to, but I don't think they're just really good foods. And when we look at things as dogma, like food allergies this way, you stay away from it, and you're not looking at the big picture of you also have to feed good, nutritious, healthy foods that aren't going to continue to damage the gut, then you're missing the boat. So that's why sometimes these lab reports drive me a little crazy.
I'm showing you this person's test. She's around 40-ish. I think she was 39 when she did her first one and 40 when she did her second one. And, you know, lots of history of food just not sitting well and digestive upset and skin breakouts and headaches and weight that wouldn't budge and all this. And she's doing really, really well now and has dropped 55 pounds and is feeling really good. There's just a few things that keep, you know, popping up. And you'll see how her thing changed. And I'm just going to make a few notes on here. In her severe intolerance, she came up with, on the ALCAT, lamb, onion, and rosemary. Well, she also came up with severe. If you look down below, it doesn't put it in there. It actually marks off the dairy and the gluten separately. So it says she had a severe reaction to gluten and gliadin. And I also put dairy in that column of severe, because whenever somebody has a severe reaction to gluten, you need to get them off dairy. So it's guilty until proven otherwise. Personally, don't think dairy is a good food for humans anyway, but some people get away with a little bit of fermented goat milk or goat yogurt or something like that. As long as it's organic, you know, that's, everybody has to choose and pick what works for them. But personally, I wanted her, so I put that in her thing. I typed it in, gluten and dairy as well. And then in the moderate intolerance, we have the hemp, sesame, amaranth, and coffee. And she also did one of the food reactivity tests. When we did the cross reactivity test, and I'll give you a little head start on what the cross reactivity test is. It's been discovered, the doctor that started the C-Rex, the whole process of being able to do those C-Rex tests with very intense immunology, is a brilliant immunologist. And I've heard him speak. I've got lots of his tapes. He's just totally brilliant. You have to listen to his stuff 3 or 4 times before you really get it, because he just goes so deep into the immunology and the neuroscience of it. And he's always been into the neuroendocrinology, and it's pretty amazing. Neuroendoimmunology. I don't know which order he says it in, but he has a way of saying it. But those three things are so married together. Well, in doing all his testing, he discovered that there was a lot of cross-reactivity. And I'd always known about dairy cross-reacting with gluten, but there's a lot of other things, and I'll be showing you those in just a little bit. But just to give you a head start, when we did her food reactivity test, she showed up with hemp, sesame, amaranth, and coffee as cross-reacting. So even though some of these foods were actually on her green list, they weren't causing an inflammation at the time this test was done. On another test, were shown to be cross-reacting with gluten. Didn't want that happening, you know, but somebody with a thyroid issue and all the other issues, we don't want her to have anything, any at all hint of cross-reacting with gluten. So I put those there in the moderate, because that's how they showed up on that test. In the mild intolerance, I added corn, potato. I guess I added dairy twice, huh? Interesting. I added corn and potato, I think, because they showed up as mild intolerance on the cross-reactivity. But also, this poor gal is left with practically nothing to eat, because she's extremely insulin resistant and leptin resistant, and every time she eats any fruit except blueberry, her sugars go up. So she's limited to very few foods, and it's really easy for her to have eaten the same things over and over. And because the leaky gut isn't quite repaired yet, what we're finding is that a lot of the foods that she ate on a regular basis, like cauliflower, is, if you look in the first list, cauliflower is in the no reaction. It's green. Well, she just loved the cauliflower, and it gave everything a nice consistency if she steamed it lightly and blended it with things. So she was eating cauliflower like crazy. Cauliflower is now in her severe intolerance list. So you've got to be really, really careful when you do something like this, whether you do an allergy test where you do a allergy provocation and elimination, or whether you do it this way with a test. You can't allow them to eat the same things over and over and over again, large quantities every day. I mean, I don't think you necessarily have to do a strict 4-day rotation where one day and then they can't do it again for 4 days, except for the severe stuff. But I think you just have to be careful not to be eating the same things over and over again, because with leaky gut, remember, it's a threshold thing. And if there's just a little bit of cauliflower going in her bloodstream, her body handles it. But if it's there every day and the gut's still leaky, the body can mount an immune response to it. And voila, a lot of things that were in the green are now in the severe, because she ate them so much. So anyway, fortunately, avocado stayed in her good list, and her coconut, because she was eating a lot of those as well, but she got lucky there. Anyway, so this is what her first test looked like, and you could see, and then I had made some food plans for her. She's like, okay, I need food plans. Like, oh my God. Okay, I'll make a week of food plans. Can I have another week of food plans? So I ended up making her probably 2 months worth of food plans, taking some base recipes that I have in a software called Living Cookbook, and going from that into creating menu plans and changing things. So I made a whole separate recipe. There's like, you can make collections in there. So I had a collection of B4B Gone recipes, which would work well for her because she's insulin resistant. And those are my insulin resistance recipes. So I started with those. We took out the ones she says, oh, I don't like bok choy, or I don't like this, or I don't like whatever. And we'd take those out. And then we would go in there and then just substitute like any, you know, the greens for what she could eat. And I made up a whole bunch of new recipes. And she has her own little little cookbook in my Living Cookbook section, in my Living Cookbook program. And it was hard. It was a lot of work. And then I said, look, you've got enough. I can't keep making your, I'm running out of ideas. So she actually hired a chef. And this chef is actually is a very good chef who's been trained in natural foods and Ayurvedic. And he really understands foods. So he's been using her lists. And we set up a time for him to talk to me. And he's like, what am I going to feed her? Oh my God. Every time I go to say, oh, I'll make her this, I find it on the list. I said, it's really training you in the creativity. So anyway, that's what we did for her. And she's doing phenomenally, but she did a lot. I mean, she did this, she did the stool test, she did the fatty acid test, she did the adrenal testing, she did the cross-reactivity, the gut permeability. I mean, she's one of the few people that I've had who said, I just want to know what this stuff is. I want to nail this. So she's done a lot of testing. But this is what they give you when you do one of these tests. They give you this day one, day two, day three, day four, but it's not kind of, they've got a starch on each day, and then they got vegetables on each day, fruits on each day. So when you look at this, it looks like, wow, she can eat a lot. But when you break it down, it's like, I don't know. You know, she's not going to eat the starches because she can't. Starches shoot her blood sugar up. And then when you look at the legumes and vegetables, some of them are actually starches again, like butternut squash and black-eyed peas. So anyway, we've never really tried. I should actually just ask her chef to take this from her new one and try to create some menu plans from it. And that's the idea, is that you could take this and make a menu plan from it. After this, they give you a list of foods to avoid, and they just describe it a little bit. I mean, I don't know. That's a real useful thing. It says a picture of a mushroom and tells you a little bit about mushrooms. So these are the things she has to avoid. And these are the ones that they took. I don't know where they... There should be more than that, but I think they just took her top ones. And then the other thing that they do, which is kind of nice, is they do food additives and colorings. Well, fortunately, she doesn't eat things with food additives and coloring. She only will eat whole, fresh foods. She's very strict. She takes her food wherever she goes. She's really strict about it. And so the severe and the moderates, she didn't have anything. She was mildly intolerant to BHT and sucralose, so we don't want her eating that anyway, right?
She also showed a sensitivity to glyphosate, which, of course, is the what's sprayed on crops. It's Roundup, basically, and it's in most of the GMO foods because they're set up to be Roundup ready. So she showed a sensitivity to that, which, of course, we want people to avoid anyway, but you know, it made it even more important for her to really be careful about using foods that were GMO.
And then she didn't have any intolerance to any of the other stuff. Then they did a test, which I really thought was cool, which is functional foods and medicinal herbs. And I don't know why they have agave in a functional food and medicinal herb. I would not put it there. But anyway, so they do that too. And now she did the deluxe panel. She did the everything you can, except for, I think she left out one section. So it was an expensive test, but she wanted to see, because she's taken all these supplements and all these herbal formulas. And you want to know if there's something in your formula that your body's reacting to. So, you know, the thing was, we had her on milk thistle. I had her on a formula with milk thistle in it. She was doing stevia in just about everything because she was insulin resistant. This was before we did the test. So it really shifted her around and really limited supplements. We really have to research hard and wide to find supplements that don't have all the stuff that she's sensitive to. But fortunately, she's got good stuff in her functional foods and medicinal herbs like Lohan. She latched onto that as a sweetener. And she adds chlorella to her smoothies. And there's other things in here. Reishi, her cook was thrilled to find that reishi was okay, and spirulina and things like that. So she's really working hard at doing this, and this is a really nice little panel. So I don't do them very often just because it's really hard. You have to have somebody who's really dedicated, that whatever the results come back, they're actually going to do it. Otherwise, they wasted their money. And, you know, in another way to do it is to do like we do in the Food Allergy Spy Training Program, which is take people through an elimination and a provocation, put them on a rare foods diet, you know, the foods they never eat. So how could they be allergic or sensitive to them if they never eat them? And then you gradually add things in a very controlled way. So that's the other way to do it. I don't know which way is easier. I mean, obviously, if you get a piece of paper that tells you what you can and can't eat, it seems like it would be easier. But these tests are, they're not 100% foolproof. There's a lot of, if you go on the internet and look up ALCAT, you'll find as many or more places, people that are skeptical of it than there are people who support it. But then you have people who do it and then they have great results. Well, personally, I think they'd have great results if they came to me and I told them what to avoid and just took off the top allergens and listened to what they were eating on a regular basis, listened to how they were reacting to food on a regular basis. They crave this. Whoa, okay. When you crave something, a lot of times it's something you're sensitive to. So when you really listen, when you learn the art of the old-fashioned art of listening to people, you can get away with not spending so much money on tests and having them just being in your presence with your love and your attention and your listening is going to be so much more therapeutic. So you do the tests when you need to. You do the tests when people ask you to. This is what I did. She wanted to do the test and I said, sure, okay, you know, fine, great. It's more practice for me, more that I get to see how it helps. But you make a judgment there. And if you really feel like someone wants a test and you don't think it's in their best interest, you're going to need to really be honest and let them know, I just don't think that's in your best interest right now. And then I wanted to just go back and let you know, when you do the regular blood antibody tests, they're usually measuring antibody titers. So they'll either measure an IgG or an IgG plus an IgE. Some labs will even measure an IgA or an IgM. Those are rare. There's less labs that do that, and it significantly adds to the cost of the test.
Now, going back to our whole list of immunoglobulins, right, the IgA protects your mucous membrane. IgE is an immediate hypersensitivity. And you know what? I don't feel like I want to spend money to find out what my immediate hypersensitivities are, because I can tell. You eat it, you get hives. You eat it, you break out. You eat it, you get a stomach ache. You eat it, you feel bad. That's what it means for immediate. So if you just pay attention, you can figure out the IgEs. The IgGs are more delayed. So the IgGs are harder to figure out. You might eat something and have a reaction, you know, 2 days later or 24 hours later. Those are harder to figure out. The IgAs are similar to the IgEs, but they're a little bit less immediate. They're the mucous membrane protection, right? Secretory IgA is what lines your gut and your lungs and your nasal passages to protect them. You'll see a lot of labs that'll offer an IgG allergy test for like $200 for 300 foods. And it seems like a really great deal because some of them are $400 or $500. But if you look and you say, well, IgG isn't enough, the only time I would trust this is if I did all of them. I got an IgG, an IgA, an IgM, and an IgE. I think it's Great Plains Labs has one of those for $1,400. And then the ALCAT test, the one that my patient did, was like $600 wholesale. That was my cost, which I passed on to her because she was in a VIP program with me. And by the way, that's what you do. You can either bundle in labs if you know that this person's going to need it when you create a program for them, or if they're in a VIP program, you can certainly pass on your professional discount to them. And if they're not, then you just charge them the full retail price because you need to get back your time for ordering and for analyzing and all that. So that's that on this. It's mixed reliability. I used to do these all the time when I first got into practice. And then I would get these results, like somebody would have a gazillion and I say, okay, you have leaky gut, right? If you have a large number of positives, some docs say over 5, some say over 10, but certainly over 10. If you have over 10 positives, that says you have leaky gut, that everything you're eating is just turning into food for your antibodies. It's like, wee, field day for the antibodies because you've got a leaky gut. And that's got to be your priority. That's got to be your priority. It's healing that leaky gut and figuring out what is actually causing it to be leaky. I mean, it could be food allergies. So sometimes going on a 5-day rare foods diet to really rest your system. Foods you almost never eat for 5 days rests that and calms down that immunological response and helps that gut to heal. Because remember, small intestine tissue turns over in 5 days. Not that you're going to have it completely healed in 5 days, but if you could do either get somebody to do a fast or a rare foods diet with most of this food blended, so there's not a lot of large particles in there to scratch up the lining, you can do wonders for that person. Absolute wonders for that person. And then you really teach them how to reintroduce foods. So a large number of positive is related to leaky gut. You can just cover your bases and put together a general leaky gut protocol for them. Or you can run the gut permeability test that we talked about in the digestive module with the measuring the zonulin and the actinomycin and the LPS. So either way, but it's really a matter of working on the leaky gut when you get that. Yes, they need to avoid those foods while you're working on the leaky gut, of course, because otherwise they're just going to keep aggravating it. So here's what I want to do. I've got two case studies on the EnteroLab stool antibody and gluten test. These are really quick and easy to go through when you see what they give you. It's just not a lot of information, but it's valuable information. It's super valuable information. So with EnteroLab, you can do the basic test, which is just anti-gliadin antibody, IgA, in the stool. Turns out that that's the best place because that's where they're sitting there and hiding, right? The antibodies don't stay around in the blood if you've been away from the food for several weeks or months. But they do kind of sit in the crypts in the intestine because that's what their job is to protect that lining. And so as soon as that gluten comes on down, it attacks. And that's why when you do a stool antibody test with EnteroLab, they tell you you don't have to go back and eat gluten. Whereas if you're trying to do a blood one, they say, oh, go back and eat a lot of gluten for the next 2 weeks. Well, damn, I want people off of gluten. I don't want them to go back on it and backtrack their whole program. That's crazy. So if you do the EnteroLab, $99, they can order it themselves. They don't even let you order it for them. You just go to their, send them to the site, EnteroLab.com, and tell them what you want to order. So get yourself familiar with that. So go there and EnteroLab.com. They can do that $99 one. They also can do stool antigens for a whole bunch of other stuff. They have their basic antigen package. It's pricey though. It's not like 200 foods for $200. It's more like 6 foods for $200. But they test the top ones that mostly cross-react with gluten. So you do that or not. And then really, here's the deal with stool tests for Entero. If somebody's real motivated, I say, look, either you can spend the $100 or you can spend the $300 or $400 to find out if you also have all the genetics for it. Or you can assume that you have it and then just let's put you on a gluten-free diet. And that's what I did. It's like, I'm not wasting my money. I know I'm gluten sensitive. I've had enough experience with it to know I'm sensitive to it. Why waste my money? Right. So that's what we did. And for most people, but there are those skeptics that are the ones that say, well, I could just eat it a little bit. And then I go, you know what? Let's do the test. Please, let's do the test because I really think this is an issue. And I don't want you to just do it a little bit because this inflammation and those antibodies can stay around for 6 months. 6 months. So if you've got an autoimmune disease, you've got thyroiditis, you've got lupus or Crohn's or irritable bowel, inflammatory bowel, some kind of arthritis, you're working with somebody with those conditions, you got to get them off gluten and whatever it takes. And I find that when people have that piece of paper in front of them, they're willing to go off of it. I've only had one person who, after they saw that, still struggled like crazy. And I don't even know now if she's off of it because she would be as soon as she got her test results back, she also found out she was allergic to, well, she found out gluten for sure, and she had the genetics for it, two of the genetic markers, so she got them from both parents, and she also had eggs. Dairy was okay, but eggs. So what did she have a craving for as soon as she got that results back? Egg sandwiches. What did she do? She started eating egg sandwiches. And so, you know, I've been working with her for a long time. It's the emotional stuff. There's some, you know, either self-sabotage or something else. And that's when you've got to really be realistic when you're working with somebody and say, do you need help with getting her some additional work with maybe something that's out of your boundaries? Or do you need to get them to do some tapping or go to a tapping workshop or go to a body image workshop or whatever it is? Or there's something there that's holding them back. So anyway, that was the only person that really did not go, oh my God, I better do this. I had one person who turned around completely, and she ended up going out and teaching other people about the importance of it, testing her whole family, getting all her kids off of it, and seeing a huge difference in how she felt. And now she's out there teaching it. So it's really awesome. But it's a really simple test. You either have the anti-gliadin, you get to choose antibodies. You can do inflammation like transglutaminase and a couple of other inflammatory markers. And then you can also add the genetic markers. So there's these two HLAs, and I'll show you them in a minute. I'm going to open up. I have that in my bag of tricks. Here's the stool antigen panel. And this is one. Yeah, she did the A and C, comprehensive gluten antigenic food sensitivity. So she did all the food sensitivities right there in the stool. And what it came up with was she had 11 antigenic foods. Mean value was 11 on antigenic foods. And IgA for anti-gliadin was 18. Now, some people will say, well, the range is less than 10, so I'm not that far off. Well, you're almost double that, right? And again, how many bullets do you want shooting at your tissues? How much antigenic activity do you want? None, really. The ideal is zero. Okay, they give you to 10, just like it's okay, it's low. With casein, it says she wasn't allergic because she had only 7 units, okay? But to me, it was like, oh, I didn't have a zero there. I think I'm staying away from it. Her egg was 11. Again, she was like, you know, it's only an 11. I said, ew. And then the soy was 5. So the soy's, you know, the soy's probably safe, and I wouldn't be eating it every day, but she's safe with the soy. But she added the gluten sensitivity gene to the panel, and her HLA-DQB1, oh, allele-1 and allele-2. So they're both the HLA-DQ21, the subtype 2-6. So really, she didn't show up for anything except for the gluten, the egg, and the dairy, you know, a little bit. They just basically send you an email. It's very informal. No pretty pictures, no bar graphs, no nothing. So foods for which there was no significant immunological activity: almond, potato, tuna, chicken, walnut, corn, pork, cashew, beef, oat, and rice. Now, this is a person who is extremely insulin resistant. So I've been trying to get her to stop potato and corn and oat and rice. But it's kind of an uphill battle. So no detectable. So these were low. So that's all she had done. So the interpretation, it says basically the level of intestinal anti-gliadin was elevated, indicative of active dietary gluten sensitivity. For optimal health, resolution, or improvement of gluten-induced syndromes, they put them into 6 categories like we talked about in the presentation: neuropsychiatric, autoimmune, asthma, abdominal, glandular deficiencies, and hyperactivity or skin disease. And then they have all the lists of stuff. So it's educational for the person. They do have a lot of information on their website for you to go through, lots of papers and stuff. They're saying that she should stay away from egg and stay away from the gluten. Interpretation of HLA-DQ: though you do not possess the main DQB1 genes predisposing to celiac, you do have 2 copies of a gene that predisposes you to gluten sensitivity. So she's not celiac, doesn't have the genes for celiac, but she has the genes for gluten sensitivity. So any DQ1, DQ2, other than that by HLA-B1. So the ones she has, they're saying, can be associated with celiac in rare cases. Okay, and then they have more information on the page where you could find out more and read a lot about it. Dr. Fine has done a really nice job of putting stuff up there. So that's basically, it's very informal. It's not as easy to read as some of those really pretty graphs that stand out. But she's basically got an issue with gluten sensitivity genetically and sensitivity to a couple of foods, not really major. So we wouldn't say that this person has a leaky gut issue. That's not the issue that we would be working on. But she definitely has insulin resistance, and she's got gluten sensitivity. And I know that if she could just make it a month without gluten, then she's going to do really, really well. But anyway, there's something emotional that's keeping her there. And you're going to find that. You're going to find that with people. So the next one is a little bit more straightforward. You get to see what the $99 test looks like. They send you an email, and it says, your fecal anti-gliadin antibody is IgA is 13. Now this was done, yeah, now is 13. Normal range is less than 10. And this was after she was on a mostly gluten-free diet. You know, she was on, you know, maybe 90% gluten-free diet for a while. And it does the same paragraph about what it can be associated with for additional information. So that's it.
She's got a 13. It's over 10. We definitely have a gluten problem. I've seen people that have them in the 250 range. Yes, but most of them come out in that, you know, somewhere between 13 and 50. And when people say, well, it's not that much, it's like, well, if your pregnancy test comes out with just a low amount of HCG and somebody else's comes out with a high amount of HCG, you're still pregnant. You're still pregnant. Whether it's low or high, it's still a problem. Now, it's different in pregnancy because the HCGs are going up throughout the pregnancy. But when you get a test done, as long as it changes the color strip, you're pregnant. Most of those are just yes or no. This says yes. It's there. So that's the way that goes. Okay.
The HLA-DQB1 tends to be the one for celiac, and then the other one is just gluten sensitivity. So it helps you to differentiate. If you have the gene that says the celiac, then it's a lifelong thing. 100%, not a morsel of gluten should cross your lips. You should be making sure that if anybody uses the pan before you with gluten, that you wash it really well. You really shaking hands with somebody. If you have that gluten, the celiac gene, it can create havoc in your body, just even mild exposure. Had a friend whose daughter, she was having trouble with her daughter with learning and behavior, and then she finally got her tested, and sure enough, she has the celiac genes, and she has gluten sensitivity. I'd been talking to her about it for about 2 years, and she was resisting, but finally she said, I think you're right, I'm going to do this, and she checked it out, and then she became like, you know, a fanatic about it. And it turned out that she would know her child had not eaten anything. She was there, and the kid would have a reaction. And it turned out that if she was at a play date with kids and the kid had a peanut butter sandwich and didn't wash their hands and then she played with her, then she would get a reaction. So that's how sensitive she was. Not everybody is that sensitive, but if you do have the gene, then you do need to be more careful than somebody that just has the sensitivity gene or somebody that just has the gluten antibodies without any of the genes. What that means is that it's a lifestyle induced, it's transient. And if they can just keep a steady, good diet lifestyle, they can have gluten periodically and it's not going to affect them. But if they keep doing it, it's going to be inflammatory. It's because we eat gluten at every meal. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Look at people, right? Toast and pancakes and then sandwiches and then pasta and bread and desserts. And they're eating it all day long with their snacks from the snack bar, the crackers and the cookies. So it's like gluten becomes this food that people are eating nonstop all day long. No wonder we get sensitive to it. Plus, it's an issue because it's hybridized. It's no longer the ancient wheat that maybe something like spelt or kamut was, you know, ages ago before they decided to hybridize it and make it so that it was really high in gluten, made the gluten content even more because it made the nice texture in the bread. And when that happened, I think with that and the frequency that we have, it is why we have such a problem with gluten. But now, even if you go back and try to eat the ancient stuff, you're still going to react. You're going to cross react to it because it's close enough. Whereas if you just started with that from, you know, early on and you didn't do it so frequently, you might not have ever developed it unless you have the genetics. So the next test that I want to look at is the Cirrex Labs Array 3. And you've got this whole really nice 35-page booklet from them that describes it. And you can just learn it at your leisure and have it there. Don't worry about memorizing it all. I still have to refer back to it because I don't use it as often. But once I do, I go, oh yeah, that makes sense. The whole science makes sense to it. So the Array 3 is the gluten subfractions. And here's the deal. Anytime you do a blood celiac panel, all they do is test you for anti-gliadin antibody and transglutaminase antibody. If you've been away from gluten for a while, that IgG in your bloodstream is going to be low because it comes up, it delays, it stays elevated for a while, and it goes down if you're not exposed to it. So it's really not an accurate test. I've had so many people who have had that test after they've sworn that they were gluten sensitive. Then they'd say, oh, the doctor said I'm not. And then they go back and eat gluten and they fall apart. So you got to trust your body. You've got to trust your intuition, but you've got to trust your body and how it reacts. Sometimes the labs are not going to give you the right picture.
So what Cyrix did was came up with the subfractions, and there's about 20 different subfractions of gluten, not just gliadin. It's very sensitive. And this was like the guy that I was telling you about, Aristo Pajani. Amazing. I've heard him talk about this long before this test became available at seminars, my relicensure seminars. I've been hearing about it and listening to him for probably the last 7 years. And he's like, yeah, he was going to come out with it. He's coming out with this stuff. And finally, yay, he has it. So we can test it. It's array 3, wheat gluten, proteome, reactivity, and autoimmunity. It's just a big fancy name. It's just the subfractions. So they talk about, you know, the measurement for gluten sensitivity, and they talk about, you know, they go through the pathways, and you can read that. And the different fractions of wheat, there's water-soluble fractions and alcohol-soluble. So gliadin is an alcohol-soluble fraction. Maybe you don't react to gliadin. Maybe you react only to this glutenin or alpha amylase inhibitor or peroxidase or any of these other pieces. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, so 12. There's 12 different subfractions that they measure. Doesn't it make sense that there's more than one? They measure the lectins, they measure that. So the whole thing just shows you pictures. These are the pieces that it measures, and you get a report. Interpretation of antibodies against wheat, gluten, and enzyme antigens. So you look down and you interpret the chart. They've got different color keys. It definitely confirms, and it's one good way in the blood that you can get it. Right. For me, I don't need to be convinced this way. I don't need to be spending a whole lot of my money. I know how I feel. I've researched it enough. I know the damage that gluten can do. And it's like, forget it. Why do I need it? When I think about it, I'm disgusted by it. I don't want it. I don't want it near me. I don't want it in me. I don't want to touch people that have been eating it. You know, it's just, I don't want it. But you're going to have people that are going to need to be convinced. If they haven't done all the research that you have, and they're not going to be willing to give up their favorite foods unless they have to. So this is a good test. So that's in your packet. Just look for that. It's called the Array 3, Cyrix Array 3. So the next one, which I like a lot, is the cross-reactivity, and I've done quite a number of these. 30% of gluten-sensitive people don't get results when they just go off of gluten. Isn't that amazing? You know, they go, wow, I'm sensitive to gluten. They go off of it and they still don't feel better. Well, it's because they're still eating other foods that they're cross-reacting to. 80% of people sensitive to gluten are said to be sensitive to casein. And the others are a little bit less than that, maybe, but the casein seems to be the biggie. So if somebody is not willing to do all the tests and spend the money, I say, well, just go off of all of it. Go off gluten and casein. I want them off of dairy anyway. I just don't think it's a good food for people to be eating, at least not on a regular basis. So this is the antibody array 4 and gluten associated sensitivity and cross reactive foods. So if you look at the list, well, you know, of course these guys are, I don't understand how these, which have gluten in it, could not cross react. It makes sense to me. Cow's milk for this person didn't, the casein stuff didn't, but look what did. Yeast, coffee, and sesame were her biggies. Yeast, coffee, and sesame. Not bad, okay? So she didn't have to stay away from all this other stuff. She did stay away from the gluten, but anything with gluten in it, because I wouldn't trust it. And she does mostly stay away from dairy, because she's been vegan for a long time, and every now and then something dairy slips across her lips. But this is what it gives you. Equivocal means it's just on the border. Anything equivocal, I have people go off of. I have them go off of it for at least a month and get it out of their system. The out of range, the ones that are higher, I have them go off of it for several months. If they're willing to redo the test, then they can go back on it. If they're not willing to redo the test, then just until they're willing to do the test again. Right? So that's the way I work it. And even with the equivocal, I would basically say, look, if you're willing to do the test again in a month to see if you're no longer equivocal after you stay away from it, then that's fine. But if you aren't, then just stay away from it until you're willing to do the test or indefinitely. So that's the Cyrix panels. There's one more Cyrix panel that I'm really excited about. It's their latest one. It measures all the autoantibodies. It measures for thyroid and intrinsic factor and all these tests that would cost you a fortune
to do if you did them on their own, because autoantibody tests are expensive. Just to run the two thyroid, well, if you do all three, which it covers, it costs you $150 just for the thyroid if you went to Direct Labs. So here's some of what it covers. You can have autoantibodies to so many things. Thyroid seems to be one of the most popular ones, as well as connective tissue like lupus and Sjogren's and scleroderma, rheumatoid arthritis. But it affects things all over the body. Intrinsic factor, which is what you need to absorb your B12. That's why I think a lot of people have B12 deficiency, even if they have B12 in their diet. Because if they're not doing it sublingually or topically on the skin, you need the intrinsic factor to kind of carry it down to the distal ileum where it gets absorbed. The pancreas, this is really big in adult onset diabetes and also child onset diabetes. The islets of Langerhans make your insulin. They've discovered that there are antibodies to those islets of Langerhans cells. There's also antibodies to insulin itself. And then there's antibodies to a couple of other enzymes. If you go and you were to look in Direct Labs and go for a diabetes autoimmune panel. And most people who are type 1 have an autoimmune disease. Most. And a lot of them haven't been told that they could get that under control before their pancreas gets completely destroyed by getting the allergies under control. And so a lot of them, they just go through their lives taking their insulin, don't realize, haven't been told that they could support their immune system and maybe decrease, if not get off, of the insulin, depending on how far along it's been. But somebody who's detected in childhood, they've discovered that dairy tends to be the big hitter in diabetes. It attacks the islets of Langerhans. People cross-react with it. So that's the thing where people go off of their gluten, but they don't go off of their dairy, and they're still having reactions. And the other thing about this, it's something to look for because it's overlooked dramatically, and I've had people come in and I go, I don't think you have type 2 diabetes. You're just not showing like type 2 diabetes. It's what's called latent adult onset autoimmune diabetes. Latent adult onset diabetes of autoimmune origin or something, because it's like LADA, L-A-D-A. Look it up if you're interested. And I've had a couple of people that I felt that way for, and we ran these tests. Nobody had ever talked to them about running these antibody tests before, and sure enough. So once we got them on a low antigenic diet and off the dairy and gluten and off the sugar and onto some really good supportive antioxidants and glutathione promoters and supported their immune system, they were able to get their sugars under control for the first time. Brain, you know, so many people with brain fog and memory problems, ADD, focus problems, disorientation, memory loss, their brain is being attacked. It can attack the cerebellum. It can attack what's called the Purkinje cells. It can attack the connective tissue in your brain. So you want to get this under control. You want to get under control. So if you know that you have antibodies to these tissues, maybe you do a little bit differently. What's the purpose of this test? Well, it will tell you years in advance of maybe something that hasn't even shown up as a symptom, but that you have those antibodies. So a lot of times I discover people's thyroid antibodies before they have thyroid symptoms or before they have the thyroid numbers out of control. Not so much before they have symptoms, because a lot of times they have symptoms sooner, but we discover that, which gives them the impetus to really take care of themselves and really get the antigenic load down and work on that leaky gut and keep the highly allergenic foods out. You can have antibodies to the kidney. That happens in lupus, and lupus is multi-system, kidney and connective tissue and heart and all these things, joints, and it's a multi-system autoimmune disease, and there's particular anti-nuclear antibodies that tend to be elevated in lupus. There's antibodies in the skin. Some of the diseases like cirrhosis and eczema are thought to be autoimmune. Mucous membranes, like Crohn's disease, is it an autoimmune disease of mucous membranes, the mucous membranes that line the gut. And then myelin, what about MS? So many people have had remission from their MS by doing a low antigenic diet, doing the gut repair, supporting the nerves with the omega-3s and really nourishing their nervous system, and gotten their MS under control. I worked with a guy, came to me, and he was hobbling in, and he hadn't been diagnosed with MS, but he was suspecting that that's what it was, and he had wanted to see if nutrition would help, and we got him on, did some allergy testing, got him on a low antigenic diet. I also did some body work, some craniosacral work on him. Got him on a clean diet, got him on his fats. He was very good about it. He came in and he had a treatment, and I, you know, put him on some stuff, and he went out. He walked for hours without getting tired, without limping, without having to use his cane. And this was a guy in his, like, he must have been in his 30s at that point. Because he was not much older than I was, and I was right out of school, so I was like mid-30s. Anyway, it worked dramatically. He hadn't gone for the MRI. He didn't want to know if it was MS, but he got a lot better. So we don't really know if it was MS or not, but he was suspecting that it was. And there's so many more. Your immune system has serious effects on your thyroid. Like, obviously, if you're creating antibodies or attacking the thyroid, that's an immune effect on the thyroid. But what happens is gut-associated lymphoid tissue, it's called the GALT. It's the lymph that lines your gut, your intestinal tract. When it gets activated by antigenic activity, it releases the lipopolysaccharide. We talked about that before, from the gut bacteria. So if you're attacking those gut bacteria, even if you're killing them off, you're releasing some of that lipopolysaccharide, and that bonds to immune complexes. And that causes an inflammatory cascade of cytokines. Remember, those are hormone-like messengers in the immune system, which leads to decreased T3, which means that metabolically your tissues are going to be suffering because you have less T3, which is what stimulates the metabolism at each cell. Increase reverse T3, because instead of you converting T4 into T3, you're converting T4 into reverse T3. Reverse T3 is metabolically inactive. You end up with decreased TSH, and this is key, because when we studied the thyroid, we talked about how typically we see increased TSH in problems with hypothyroid. But typically, you're not going to see increased TSH with decreased T3. We oftentimes look at that as maybe it's a pituitary problem, like the pituitary is having an issue making TSH. It could be an autoimmune where the Hashimoto's antibodies, the thyroid peroxidase antibody, is actually attacking your TSH. So that's a possibility. And also having some sort of another immune reaction that's causing this from the cytokines. And then it also causes the T3 receptor site resistance. So you've got triple whammy. TSH is not stimulating the thyroid to produce more, so you're producing less. The conversion from T4 to T3 is going to reverse T3 instead of T3, so you don't have enough metabolically active T3 going to your tissues. And then the receptor sites are becoming resistant. Couple that with stress. The cortisol also zaps the receptor sites, and you've got somebody who looks on paper that they're not so bad if you just do the standard way of testing, which is run TSH, maybe T4. You miss it. You miss the T3. Most people don't run the T3. And I was taught you don't need to run the T3. And as I started doing it, I'm like, this is not right. I want my T3. I want to know what my tissues are getting. What good does it do to know what the thyroid is making? I want to know what's reaching those receptors. And even if the T3 is reaching those receptors, if a person's still having thyroid symptoms and the labs are completely normal, you know, the reverse T3 is normal, the T3 is good, the TSH is good, then you know that they have receptor site resistance. And you have to work with them on the stress levels. You have to work with them on reducing the amount of cortisol that's reaching them. You have to work with them on anti-inflammatory things. And you have to work on this immune system, because it could be that it's gut bacteria that are causing the thyroid problem. So there we go. So I love this little picture that the Cerex Labs did. Your dietary proteins coupled with an infection and chemicals in the environment and all that extra strain on your body makes you not such a happy camper. And this is a chart, right? Your genetics and epigenetics are at the left-hand side. Your genetics you don't change. Epigenetics, we're finding out that you can change and alter by behaviors. You can make them genes express or not express based on how you feed them, basically. So you may have an initiating factor like a stress, a divorce, a death in the family, something dramatic happens, change of job, loss of job, and that causes you to be stressed. And then the susceptibility in your genes, plus any environmental factors, diet, allergens, infections, toxins, that causes you to have an immune reaction. Okay? And then what that does is causes you to have the outcome of loss of tolerance, immune reaction to environmental factors, and self-antigens. What does that basically mean is that you're hypersensitive to the environment, you're overreacting to things in your environment, and you're attacking yourself. Okay? So if you have the same genetics, but you don't have all those stressful problems, you end up with what's on the top, which is immune tolerance and protection from environmental factors. Okay? So it's really cool how all this works together. These are all antigens that are tested. It's huge. It's two pages long or three pages long. There's parietal cell, intrinsic factor, and within each one, there's several antibodies. So if you look at, it's one antigen. They have the antigen over here. And then it's different conditions that it's associated with. Well, parietal cell are the cells in your stomach that make what? What did we talk about earlier in digestion? Stomach acid, pepsin. So if you have antibodies to your parietal cells, you're not going to be making hydrochloric acid. You're not going to be digesting your protein. You're not going to be getting your minerals in. And you're not going to be making intrinsic factor very well. Then you can have an antibody to intrinsic factor itself, which means you end up with pernicious anemia, B12 deficiency that can lead to irreversible neurologic damage if you don't do something about it. Oh, these are the ones in Crohn's disease, ASCA and ANCA, is Beckett syndrome with GI involvement, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis. So you can know if you have a predisposition to these things. Tropomyosin, which is related to ulcerative colitis, that's a connective tissue piece, colon, autoimmunity, and bowel. So that's related to your bowel. Thyroglobulin, which is related to the thyroglobulin is a binding protein for thyroid. And if you have antibodies to that, then you've got problems with autoimmune thyroid disease. Graves' disease often has that too. More likely, if you have thyroglobulin and thyroid peroxidase, it's going to be Hashimoto's rather than Graves'. And there's another one called TSI, thyroid stimulating immunoglobulin, which is more related to Graves' disease. You've got hydroxylase, which attacks your adrenal cortex, which is going to lead to adrenal insufficiency. You may be doing all this great adrenal support and you discover that, whoa, it's because I have an autoimmune. I have antibodies that are attacking that. So if you're working with people and they're not getting the results from the stuff you know works and should work, you got to dig deeper. Right, you got to start looking for the zebras. You know, there's a whole thing when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras. But if you think horses and it turns out not to be horses, you got to go looking for the zebras. And this test can be a lifesaver because you can be bending over backwards trying to give them all the great adrenal adaptogens and it's not working. Myocardial peptide, oh my God, that scares me, right? Who wants to have antibodies attacking their heart? Myocarditis, that attacks the muscle in the heart. Nah. Another one that attacks the heart, alpha myosin. Yikes. Then you've got the antiphospholipid syndrome and lupus and platelet glycoprotein, which is also associated with these autoimmune like lupus, cardiovascular, and thrombocytopenia, which is very low platelet count, which can be autoimmune. So this antibody panel can explain a lot of things. And if it comes out negative, great. Then you know that this isn't the area to be really focusing your attention. But the chances are good that if you've got a lot of resistant things going on, a lot of resistance to protocols that should work, that this is a great test to go for. It's worth the $450 to do it. You can even have it to your ovaries and testes and have endocrine disorders, people who have menstrual stuff or a lack of libido and erectile dysfunction and all, they may have antibodies that they don't know about. Fibulin for osteoarthritis, collagen, and that affects lupus and Sjogren's, and it does affect scleroderma, I think, even though they didn't write that down, arthritis. There's something called arthritis peptides, which is in the mixed connective tissue disease, RA, and osteoarthritis. So you're getting the idea. Look, there's even antibodies against your osteocytes, which is your bone-forming cells. So you can be having osteoporosis, osteopenia, even though you maybe, I'm taking all this calcium, I'm taking all these great herbs that are high in calcium, but I still have low bone density. What the heck is going on? You might have an autoimmune disease. And then cytochrome P450 is one of the main detox enzymes in your liver. And if you have antibodies attacking it, you may end up with things that are liver-oriented, hepatitis. You may have hepatocellular carcinoma. You can have a lot of things happening. You'll have low detox function. You may end up gaining weight because your liver detox functions are so bad that every morsel of stuff that comes in you, it can't get detoxified and it gets stored. Insulin and islet cells. I've tested these before with great, great success. So somebody who has, like, they're trying really hard to do all this stuff with their blood sugars and it's not working. Well, it could be that they have islet cell antibodies and you have to work on the immune system. So I look at, we're so much focused on working on the disease, the end manifestation, like a thyroid condition or a lupus or something that affects the muscles or something that affects the pancreas. But it may be that we need to work on the immune system and get that immune system working strong and get the gut cleaned up so that the gut immune system is working strong and everything else can start to fall into place. That leaky gut has to be fixed. The myelin-based protein, I can just keep going on and on. There's just way more. There's some cerebellar, synapsin, which has to do with the neurotransmitters and the synapses, alpha and beta tubulin, which affects demyelinating disease. So people who have these diseases, it's a great test. And I think it's for our chronic patients who we just don't, we're like at a loss. What do we do next? They're not responding, or they come to you after having been to lots of practitioners. This may be the one stone that you can unturn and get going for them. So I can't stress enough looking into and reading the documentation about this. You have this handout. These are really rich documents. You can learn so much about the immune system by going through these documents. So they have lots of information. You can just open it and you can click and link to wherever you want to go to. So if you want to look at the pathophysiology, you can go right there. They have these beautiful pictures worth 1,000 words. So all the different factors. And then there's a chart. It's one you can do at home. It's Oxidata. You can get this from Apex. It's a urine test. It takes you 5 minutes to do. It doesn't cost much. I think to get the reagents for one test, depending on whether you buy one or a whole bunch, is anywhere from, let's say, $12 to $16. So it's pretty inexpensive. You can do it at home. You don't have to go to the lab. You don't have to drive. Basically, it measures MDA, which is a free radical that's indicative of overall free radical activity, oxidative stress, lipid peroxidation. And it's really easy to do. You pee into a cup, you take the top off this little cylinder, you put the little vial, the little tube in there, you pull up some urine, you drop the urine in up to the line, and then you wait 5 minutes. And then you compare it to this card. The higher and deeper red you are, the more oxidation you have. The zero, I've never seen. I've seen people with ones. I a lot of times see people with the threes and fours. And it's a high level of oxidation. A lot of times it's caused by stress. A lot of times it's because there's so many oxidative byproducts of being stressed. That's why I so emphasize using the HeartMath techniques, or if you like tapping techniques, or if you have some other form of something you can do throughout the day. And I mean, meditation is great, yoga is great, but they take time. But I need you to also have something that you're teaching people to do that they could do throughout the day, like the tapping or like the HeartMath. And the HeartMath's great because you can do it and nobody even knows you're doing it. So there's a number of things like that where you're resetting, reprogramming. So the last piece I really want to talk about is inflammation. And inflammation is controlled by the immune system, right? When you have an attack, you have an invader, your body attacks it, it creates inflammation. Many of you have seen this chart before. I want to just go through it really quickly. If you can memorize this chart, and I've got this chart memorized because I've been sharing it with people for the last 22 years. I sit down knee to knee with people, or I sit down over the internet. I explain what's happening in your body. Something called the inflammatory cascade, which happens in all your cell membranes. It starts with two fats, alpha-linoleic acid and alpha-linolenic acid. Linoleic is omega-6, linolenic is omega-3. So on the left-hand side, we have omega-6. If you have it printed out, you can write that there. And on the right-hand side, it's omega-3. And we need balance in these pathways in order to have those little healthy firemen that you see sitting about halfway down, helping you and putting out the fires. So what happens is, if you have too much on the side of the omega-6, you're going to have DGLA that gets converted into arachidonic acid, which, look what it does, it lights fires. And then if you have enough EPA, it displaces that. It gets converted to prostaglandin E3 and E1, and you displace the arachidonic acid. If you have too much omega-6 and not enough omega-3, not enough EPA, you're going to have more fire. You're going to have more arachidonic acid. And the beauty of the test I'm going to share with you now is that you can measure this. So when you have arachidonic acid that gets converted down to leukotrienes, these are the like big dude flames. These are the big dude flames. The ones on the other side, the thromboxanes, are not quite as potent. And we'll see on the next picture when we look at nutritional intervention for this. And these are enzymes. Anything that ends in ACE is an enzyme, and that's what catalyzes that reaction. So we go from arachidonic acid to lipoxygenase and cyclooxygenase, and down to these thromboxanes. But really important is up at the top, this enzyme, delta 60 saturase, because that's what helps you and your patients to convert their food form of the omega-3s and 6s into the long chain EPA and GLA. And this delta 60 saturase has a bunch of cofactors, which we're going to look at on the next slide. If they're deficient, if they're eating processed food, they're not getting enough B vitamins, if they have low stomach acid, they're not getting enough minerals, they are not going to be able to convert their alpha-linolenic to EPA. And the thing is, everybody, you know, there's all the literature about how, that's a very slow conversion, it doesn't happen. I've seen studies that show it can go up to 30% efficiency in that conversion versus 2% in some people. Why? I believe it's because most people are not on the kinds of diets that we're recommending to people, which are high in vegetables, high in greens, high in superfoods that are loaded with the nutrition and the nutrients they need to convert. So just my theory, and let me show you. Whee! This chart, please print it out, keep it handy, and make sure you know this chart. Know this chart. Okay, because this is going to help you explain to people why you're recommending some of the things you're recommending to them. So at the top, we have omega-3 on the right. Things like flax seeds, chia seeds, hemp seeds, and walnuts. It's in the gold box. Linoleic is in things like sesame, sunflower, almond, pumpkin, and there are plenty of others. I just chose those. I chose those because they're good for other things, alkalizing and high in zinc and high in phospholipids in the sunflower, and sesame's high in calcium. So they're really good foods. But in balance, if you have like pounds of this stuff compared to ounces of the flax, chia, etc., you're going to have an omega-6 imbalance and you're going to go more towards inflammation. So this enzyme, this lovely enzyme, delta-60 saturase, catalyzes both sides. Either one of them elongates. It's an elongation enzyme. And you can protect this enzyme by decreasing trans fats, alcohol, coffee, and food additives. So all the things we know to tell people. But there's the nutrients. This is the key. Why do you think the average person doesn't convert and they need to take in long chains? Who has all these B vitamins intact? They're either not eating them because they're eating white flour and white rice and all that, or they are eating the whole grains, but they're so stressed out that their body's using these to just make it through the day. Or they have low stomach acid, or maybe some antibodies that's zapping away at the B12. Or their adrenals are working on overdrive, which is zapping away the vitamin C. Right? The vitamin E, if they're eating a lot of polyunsaturated fats and they're eating a lot of fats that have been heated, that vitamin E is an antioxidant that helps to protect you from that. So the vitamin E is being zonked. The zinc. Zinc has been shown to be needed in very high amounts, sometimes because of a genetic or congenital need that's been passed on, as well as the environment that doesn't support high zinc. You need to be getting these foods daily and in good quantities. Magnesium. Lots in green leafy vegetables. And some people aren't digesting their green leafy vegetables that well. So magnesium's super important. You know, you may get somebody on a liquid magnesium that they put into their smoothies or into their water or something. And then biotin, which is often overlooked in this cascade. You need it all. And if you add saturated fat, like coconut, lauric acid or muriatic acid, it helps to do this conversion by tenfold. So if you have all these nutrients intact, and every time you eat some of these omega-3 shorts like flaxseed, chia, hemp, and walnut, if you mix it with coconut, you're going to increase that conversion. If you also at the same time maybe make a big bowl of chia pudding and sprinkle flax on top and hemp on top, and add a squirt of B vitamins to it, and add a squirt of liquid minerals to it, and maybe even add a little bit of powdered vitamin C. That Health Force Nutritionals has one that tastes really good. It's berries and all that. You can make this really amazing bowl of chia pudding that gets amazing results. And then you put coconut in it, of course. And that would be this, like, oh my God, you want to talk about superfood. You want to talk about a breakfast of champions. That's a breakfast of champions. That's going to get you into this anti-inflammatory mode, which is going to help support your immune system, which is going to help keep the inflammation down, heal your leaky gut, and make you feel fabulous, or your patients feel fabulous. But you first, you do it first so that you can share it with them. The EPA and DHA, of course, come from marine phospholipids, fish, and algae. And people overlook that when people say, well, you can't be vegetarian. You have to get your omega-3s from fish. I say, but where does the fish get it? They get it from the algae. Why can't I just eat the algae? Oh, they concentrate it. Yeah, but they also concentrate the toxins. I don't want the toxins. I don't want that extra mercury. I mean, even the government is saying don't eat fish more than twice a week. And if they're saying twice a week, I'm saying no time a week or half a time a week, because it's got a lot of toxicity in it still from the oceans that we've polluted. So you can get it from algae, and now there's some algae supplements. I take one called Opti-3, which has 200 milligrams of EPA and 400 milligrams of DHA in each capsule. And I take two or three of those a day. Now, I want to support myself in this. On the other side, on the GLA side, some of the things that contain GLA, which we need for a lot of functions in our body, well, we don't eat on a regular basis. Borage oil, black currant oil, and even primrose oil, they have it. You also get it in hemp, which is not down there because it's not as high as those. Hemp and spirulina are good sources of GLA. Okay. So rather than taking a lot of the linoleic acid, the GLA will tend to convert more to the prostaglandin E1, which is anti-inflammatory, rather than going down the DGLA path to arachidonic acid. So we give the firemen help. We give them help by providing them with nutrition, and then these firemen can put out the fire for us. And then you can help them even further by some of these things in the orange boxes at the bottom, which directly subdue the conversion from arachidonic acid down to these thromboxanes and leukotrienes, which are very inflammatory. Bioflavonoids, ginger, wonderful. Vitamin E, extra EPA, zinc, and selenium. So these are foods that are going to support you and make sure that you're getting these nutrients and telling your people to get these nutrients on a regular basis. So it's really important to keep that AA-EPA ratio optimal. The optimal is usually between 1.5 and 3. It's considered unwell to have a ratio above 10. And we'll look at these tests and see that most of the people that I've measured have theirs above 10. Anything over 15 means you've got a lot of inflammation in the blood, and you've got to be taken down. It's estimated that the average American serum AA-EPA ratio is 11. And based on what I've seen, it's probably higher than that in the people with diseases. Like chronic illnesses and disease typically have scores above 15. And when you look at what they're eating a lot more of it than they should. And I've created a tool for you, and you can share this with your people, a tool to help you to control that omega-6, omega-3 ratio on the intake. So the delta-6 desaturase is that enzyme up at the top where we want to support that. The conversion of ALA to EPA DHA is estimated to be 2
to a high of 8% with an average of 3.8%. But one study measured it at 36% in females. It's less efficient in babies and elderly. So we want to look at that study to see if we could figure out what those females were doing differently. You just have to avoid these things. So you want to ask your patients if they're using any trans fats. And don't just say, are you eating trans fats? Are you eating hydrogenated oils? Are you eating margarine or shortening? You want to get into, are you heating your oils? Do you get Wesson oil at the store? Do you get that cold pressed safflower oil at the health food store and then come home and put it in the pan? It's pretty much dead when you get it. Because when they say low heat, they don't really mean low heat, and it's been in a clear bottle on the shelf for who knows how long. Fats don't last that long. They don't. They oxidize. And when you take in oxidized fats, they become part of your cell membrane. They stiffen it. They make it less able to transport nutrients in and wastes out. Okay? They creates more inflammation. So things that will inhibit Delta 6 desaturase is if you have too much omega 6, which I already told you. If you have too much olive oil, which is oleic. So it's great to have a tablespoon of olive oil in your salad dressing, but if you're drenching everything in it, that excess oleic acid can inhibit that Delta 6 desaturase and you won't elongate. And then the other things that inhibit it are sugar, caffeine, alcohol, additives, protein deficiencies, right? So this HCL thing that we talked about earlier in the digestive module is like, whoa, this protein deficiency is just coming up to bite us in the you-know-what all over the place. It's affecting our inflammatory pathways. And then there's deficiency of biotin, vitamin E, zinc, B12, and B6, and of course, good old smoking, which we all know, and hopefully all of our patients know that is a no-no. So to improve the Delta 6 desaturase, get them on coconut oil, or I don't even like coconut oil. I don't like any oils. I really like the whole food. I use the coconut artisanic coconut cream in a jar, or I get my fresh, the dried coconut, the flaked coconut, and I put it in my BlendTec blender, and there's a special jar they have that you can make nut butters with, and I make my coconut that way. I get that mixed up, and then I use it to make sauces. I made some konjac noodles. In the blender, I put a whole bunch of greens, raw and slightly steamed, like broccoli and cabbage and cauliflower, blended it all up, and then put in coconut cream and some Thai spices and some lime and some lemongrass and made a curry. And I served it to a friend and my husband and I, and we loved it. It was so good. And the sauce was all green leafy vegetables, which is like amazing. Then we put some chopped up veggies on top. So teach your people how to do this stuff. Show them how much fun it is. When you have lauric acid present in your diet, which is found in coconut oil, the long chain omega-6s will accumulate in the tissues even when your fatty acids are low. Okay, they'll still accumulate. So it's really powerful, that lauric acid. Plus, it's a good antiviral. This is the tool I created, and many of you have seen it before if you've been on other programs with me. And it's just a wonderful little spreadsheet that all you have to do is go in and plug in numbers. So for example, this says flax seeds, 1 ounce, has 1.8 total grams of fatty acid, right? Of omega-3 fatty acid, and 0.4. So the ratio of 6 to 3 is only 0.2 in flax. In hemp, it's closer to 3. So there's 3 times as much omega-6. That's still okay. Once you get above that, you want to be careful to balance it. Chia is great because it's got a 0.32. Pumpkin seeds, woo-hoo-hoo. People tell me, oh yeah, pumpkin seeds are a good source of omega-3. No, they're not. This is according to the U.S. Gov. 0.1 grams of omega-3 with 5.1 omega-6, that's 107 ratio. Poppy seeds, 96. Sesame seeds, 67. Sunflower, 85. And it goes on. There's a lot of others in the chart. So the chart has just about every fatty food I could think of, and it rates it. And just to give you an example, how much omega-3 is in some salmon, 3 ounces of salmon, you've got 3.37 of the omega-3 short chain, 0.21 of EPA and 0.98. So it's not really that high. But if we look at what we need,
If you don't eat fish, the recommended intake of ALA is 10 because we want to make up for that inefficient conversion. Because we really, according to the government, we only need a little bit. We only need ALA, 2.2 grams a day, which you could see easily you can get from an ounce of hemp seed, right? And EPA 0.65, which you can easily get. Well, you can even easily get that from salmon. So salmon may not be the best source. Anyway, so you really can up this and say, well, you know, let me get 10 even, which is easy enough to get with some hemp seeds and chia seeds and all these other things that are high. So, and I give you this in a spreadsheet form so you can plug how much you had and it'll tell you how much total. And then at the end bottom, it'll tell you your ratio for the day. So if you're trying to make up a recipe, you can use it and say, woo, I better add more coconut and take away some of the almond and make that a little bit more omega-6-3 friendly. So the fatty acid profile. I want to switch to a real one so you can see the three pages. This is the most important page. They do give you their interpretations, but I don't usually agree with their interpretations. So they give you a front page, which basically is the summary. And in this case, it says, well, your polyunsaturated omega-3 DHA is low. And what's the intervention? They're recommending fish oils or extracts. What is the metabolic association? Impaired nerve function, especially the eye. And also, there's a lot more that DHA does. It balances blood sugar, and it's important for brain and focus and brain chemistry. Linoleic, I rarely see that low. They are recommending sunflower or organic canola oil. I would never recommend that. If somebody's low in their linoleic acid, I'm going to recommend some things that are a little bit better than canola oil. I would be recommending whole food fats, maybe some pumpkin seeds, almonds, sunflower seeds, whole sunflower seeds, but not the oil. Don't recommend the oil in those things because they're too extracted. And then they didn't have a problem with trans and their ratio. The other problem with this is that when you look at this summary, it's good to look at the summary, don't get me wrong. But when you do, you're going to temper it with your own experience. I've done hundreds of these. And after doing hundreds of these, you kind of can do them in your sleep and I can do them really quickly and really get at what's going on with people. So we'll see if I agree, how much of that I agree with. This is the blood spot fatty acid profile. Genova and Metametrics also has a full-blown, you know, whole blood fatty acid profile, which goes through all the different fats. And if you have somebody with a really severe neurologic condition, you may want to do that to see where some of them are off. But for this, it's just the main ones. I do these for people who have inflammatory conditions, depression, autoimmune things, so we can balance these inflammatory pathways. So I look at this first one and I say, okay, alpha-linoleic acid is high, it's a good range, healthy range. That's the intake, flax, chia, hemp, etc. EPA is high, even higher than that. My suspicion is that this person is taking fish oil of some sort, a high EPA fish oil, because usually people don't have such great conversions like that, so they're probably taking a source of EPA. And the reason I say that is that their DHA is low. So they're probably taking one of those high EPA fish oils that doesn't have enough DHA. And so for this person, what I would recommend is that they get some DHA. You can get algae-based DHA. I would probably have them take 400 to 600 units a day, grams a day, milligrams a day, and go from there. Maybe they need more. They may need up to a gram. So we'll play with that. On the omega-6 side, they've got really low. Why did they say? Oh, yeah, they do have really low linoleic acid. They have really low GLA. And they have high DGLA and low arachidonic acid, which is surprising with the high DGLA. They may be using up their arachidonic acid because they have a lot of inflammation and they're not converting from DGLA into arachidonic acid as quickly as they could. Or they may be short of some of the vitamins, like B6 and all, and they're out of balance. So in this particular case, I would probably put them on some raw nuts or seeds that are high in omega-6, but not too much. We don't want to throw that ratio off, not too much. So make them have a serving or two more of those. I would give them something that has GLA. Probably hemp seeds would be good, or some spirulina. And the other thing would be like a GLA supplement, evening primrose oil, which is kind of a lower percentage, or borage oil, which is a really high percentage. Now, if this person also had some female, or mostly female reproductive kind of symptoms, I probably go with the evening primrose because it has some extra oomph for there. And then the DGLA, I wouldn't do anything for that. And the arachidonic is where I'd like it to stay. The total trans fats are high. So remember that thing we saw about the immune system creating trans fats? Well, if this person, of course, we'd know the person, right? When we're running it, we'd know what their diet was like. But if you're running this and this is a person who's just not eating trans fats, then I would say, woo, something's happening here. But they may be eating canola oil. Maybe they are eating some of those polyunsaturated oils that are oxidized and they're getting trans fats that way, right? So that's where I would look and say, let's look at what their diet's like. They may have one of those gut-associated lymphatic problems where it's triggering the hydrogenation of some of the oils that they're eating, the polyunsaturates that they're eating. Because they're obviously getting some, but they're probably getting a lot of chia and all, and flaxseed oil. Maybe they're eating a lot of flaxseed oil, and some of that is being converted. So we look at the ratios. The main ratio that I care about is the AAEPA, and in this particular case, because their EPA is so high and their arachidonic is low, this is actually perfect. So this is a low in terms of inflammatory. The problem is their index of omega-3s is low because their DHA is low. So in this particular case, the main thing that I would be doing is bringing up their DHA and then getting them a good source of GLA and finding out about their immune system. Okay. And then the last page, they usually do a summary. They'll tell you how much they want you to take of stuff. Fish oil, 3 grams. That's a lot of fish oil. I would rather see, I wouldn't put somebody on 3 grams of fish oil a day when their EPA is that high. I just don't think that's a good idea. They may end up with too much anticoagulation. I would put them on DHA, pure DHA. And that could be fish source if somebody wanted it to be, but I would, cod liver is high, but it still has the EPA. I'd rather put them on pure DHA to try to bring that up. And instead of sunflower or canola oil, I'd put them on whole food. Omega-6 is not too much. And then I would also put them on something like borage oil to bring up that GLA. So that's what I would do differently from this one.
This concludes our immune assessment module. And what we're going to do is continue on the next module. We have a whole set of case analyses. So we're going to do fatty acid interpretation on the next module. So all of the stuff that you just learned about analyzing for inflammation, you're going to go into much better depth. And we're going to go through case after case after case to really help you to understand how these work. This is a super important test. I run it a lot and it gives me great information. And even without a history on people, as you'll see as I go through some of these cases, you can get so much information about what they're eating. And when you feed it back to them, they almost think you're clairvoyant. So I hope you enjoyed this, and I can't wait to see you on the next module. This is Dr. Rita Marie, and enjoy and put this stuff into practice.